Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com. Today, we reprise some conversations on infrastructure finance, founding factors of the American monetary system going back to the Revolution, and a look at the new landscape of consumerism. Are we entering a new kind of consumer age? Hello, I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus of the Public Banking Institute and co-host with Ellen Brown for It's Our Money. Today, we want to share some insights delivered here previously that consider the management policies of our money around the topic of infrastructure, and to look back at when the state banking movement actually started in America, way back before the Revolutionary War, and what the resilient themes and issues are that we continue to deal with in the current growing drive for new public banks. Our guests are historian, playwright, teacher, actor, radio host, and farmer Jim Hoag of Vermont, who provides one of the most candid and bracing looks at how America got its monetary start and who and what were influencing that process. Then a bit later, we talk with Dr. Maury Cohen, author of the book, The Future of Consumer Society, Prospects for Sustainability in the New Economy. While this program's interviews were recorded over a year ago, the status of their reflection remains very current. One such metric of our economic health is whether the American dream of growing self-sufficiency and well-being is being realized with all the changing dynamics of our day. Apparently, it isn't. New research from various sources, both governmental and academic, indicate that the U.S. poverty rate is closing in on the 50% factor, with wealth, that is, sustained equity and sufficient financial mobility and security, virtually non-existent in the bottom 40% of our populace. From the UN, the United Way, the Congressional Research Offices, and even the Federal Reserve, Americans are struggling with maintaining their positions on the slippery slopes of the American economy. This reality is one of the reasons that cities and states around the country are now driving toward creating their own public banks to preserve some of the money that gets automatically shipped off to Wall Street rather than kept at home for investment. One such area of concern is infrastructure spending and how we can either save $1 trillion through financing it ourselves or sending that money into the hands of private capital profiteers. Ellen and I talked about that in an earlier program, and it's worth hearing once again. She discusses how the Trump administration plan for infrastructure financing repeats the model of public works for private profits rather than public dollars for public works. We discussed the Trump plan.
The plan proposed by the Trump team for solving the infrastructure crisis is public-private partnerships drawing on private equity firms, which will make a lot of money. The plan is billed as it won't increase taxes, it won't increase the federal debt, which is true because they're planning to give it all away to private equity firms, which will then charge us user fees. We the people are going to wind up paying. It's just not going to be through the government. So the government's off the hook, but we'll be paying user fees and tolls and so forth. And those can be quite steep, as we've seen in various cities that have, for example, with water, if you privatize the water or you have public-private partnerships, these private equity firms want like 8 to 18%, and that's what they get. So somebody's got to pay that 8 to 18%. Actually, private equity, on average, earns 12%. By comparison, the Bank of North Dakota now has infrastructure loans to its local communities for 2%, 30-year 2% loans. So if you figure out the difference in interest over a 10-year program, we the people could save $1 trillion by funding infrastructure, either through local public banks modeled on the Bank of North Dakota, or there are also federal proposals. For example, Tim Canova, who's a professor in Florida, and we've interviewed before, who's very, very sharp, says that the Federal Reserve could do it as qualitative easing. In other words, like quantitative easing, but money that actually gets out there in the real economy for infrastructure. And Bernie Sanders in 2013 proposed that the post office could do it. We could have a network of post offices, and the deposits could then be used to buy bonds that would be infrastructure bonds that would be used for federal infrastructure.
So all these alternatives to a very expensive and very troublesome sort of a landscape of giving away public assets to private hands for profit that promises higher prices, less control, and a loss of equity. It's a pretty clear choice, but it's being driven by strong big money interests, isn't it?
One assumes. I don't have an inside track on that. But still, they're trying to get around. For years now, Democrats and Republicans agree that we have to do something about infrastructure, but they can't agree on how to pay for it because they won't pass a bill that allows taxes to go up, and they don't want to go further into debt. So the public-private partnership was supposed to be a third solution that avoided putting the government further into debt, but it'll still fall on us, the people. So they're not actually looking at 2% infrastructure loans. So I was just proposing that we could actually do it much more cheaply.
Local public banks could be sources for some of that investment. But it also reminds me of the war bonds that were issued back when government was raising money to invest in the war effort. And people got to participate in that, which I thought was a pretty neat variation of how public finance could be realized.
In the 1930s, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was basically a publicly owned bank, although it wasn't chartered as a bank. But what it did was recycle funds, and they did sell bonds at quite low interest. Most of the bonds were bought by the Treasury, and then you could ask where the Treasury got the money created out of thin air, no doubt, drawn from their Federal Reserve bank account. And through that, they managed to rebuild the entire country. And at the end of 20 years, they had turned a profit on these loans. So it's a win-win. You get your infrastructure and you make a profit on the loans.
So there's a great tradition of America financing itself, like Lincoln did with the Civil War. I think that's a very important glitch on the horizon of, oh my gosh, we don't have any money, we have to borrow it from the big financial entities. Now, there are big changes going on with cash itself. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, well, in India, in November, in a surprise move, the Indian Prime Minister Modi required the two largest bills, which is the vast majority of the money supply, to be turned into the banks. And people only had 2 months to do it. And interestingly, they managed to gather up 97% of these bills. These are bills equal to $7.50 and $15. Like, they weren't very large bills from our perspective, but they were the largest available. So it was a great stress on a lot of people because if you had over a certain amount, you had to show where you got it and that you got it legitimately and that you had paid taxes on it. And if you hadn't paid taxes on it, then you had to pay double what you would have paid on taxes. But still, people turned in their money because they didn't have any choice. It wasn't going to be good for anything after that. Hmm. And they're trading them in for different bills, which I guess are now trackable. But there weren't nearly enough bills to go around. So, and a lot of people don't have bank accounts. India is basically all cash society, which means they don't pay taxes. So 99% of Indians don't pay taxes, and that was the reason for the move. So it depends on your point of view. In one sense, it was successful because they did manage to get everything sort of digitalized and trackable now. But it was a very upsetting, chaotic for the people. It was very fast and unexpected. But now they're talking about it elsewhere, like in Australia. People are talking about it here. Some banks are going cashless. And the argument here, the strong argument, is that the central banks have lost control of monetary policy because they can't go below the zero bound, which is meaning they can't drop interest rates below zero, and that if they could force people to spend their money and that would stimulate the economy, which to me is just the most bogus argument. And yet this is the big, supposedly brilliant argument for going cashless.
Well,
it's true that if you give the people the money and then you like put a stamp tax on it so that it decays over time, that they will spend it. But they're not going to go out and spend their hard-earned savings. I think people have something, on average, isn't it, something like $400 is all people have in savings on average. They're not going to go out and spend that money just because they're going to get charged to keep it in a bank. They still need the money. They're just going to have to deal with the charge. They can't go spend it frivolously. They need it for their food and their mortgage.
Yeah. Well, money takes yet another historic change and turn. If it turns from tally sticks to digits at this point.
We're definitely at the point of a millennial change in money and banking and how we view the whole thing. That's what I've been writing about.
And one of the important issues that's a part of this cashless business is that it no longer becomes an anonymous possession, but they know where your money is and they have access to it. So when you have a tally stick or you've got a dollar bill in your wallet, that's who knows where you got it. Presumably it's yours, but in the new digital world, there will be no question. You either have it or you don't. We know where it is.
Yeah, so it's good and bad. I mean, on the one hand, that eliminates privacy.
Right.
Maybe some people want to invest in pornography or something like that. They don't want that to be trackable. But if you do it on blockchain, then it can be both private and public. In other words, you can track the exchange, but you can't necessarily track what it was for or who the people were. But you can make sure that things aren't duplicated. So I can see several advantages to going cashless, except it does seem to me you definitely want to keep some sort of backup currency in case, like, the computers go down. But one advantage is that you can make it, like, on a blockchain, you can make it all secure so that you can't duplicate it, so you can eliminate fraud. And the other advantage would be if we actually had a national digital system of money issued by the central government, in other words, going back to government-issued money. Let's assume we actually had a central bank that served the people, like we have had at certain times in our history, like under Mariner Eccles during World War II. So if we had a truly national central bank, which then we could all have our bank accounts at the central bank, as they're talking about in at the Bank of England right now, then you could do a universal basic income guarantee where everybody gets a set amount of money every month, which I think is inevitably coming, and we could do that as quantitative easing. In other words, you don't have to increase taxes, which is going to be impossible if we have 80% of people being replaced by mechanization sometime in the not-too-distant future, as is predicted. Who's going to support those 80% of people? You can't do it on welfare because you've only got 20% of people working. They're not going to be able to support 80%. So you're going to have to just issue the money, and I've shown various ways that that wouldn't be inflationary, but the very fast, convenient way to do it would just be digitally on your card. So you've got a card that every month gets another $1,000 on it, and then you can spend it.
Yeah. Well, big change is coming. Perfect time for public banks to be emerging into these discussions, whether it's infrastructure or other accounts. It's an exciting time. Well, let's see what happens next, Ellen.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Exciting times, yes. My guest today is Jim Hogue, an actor, writer, teacher, farmer, radio talk show host, and longtime public banking activist from Vermont. Jim is the author of 10 plays and many articles, one of which I particularly want to discuss here, on the history of the State Bank of Vermont. The article was published in the Vermont Independent and is titled Battle Over Banking, a Public Bank for the Republic of Vermont. It is currently posted in the Public Banking Institute blog at publicbankinginstitute.org. Hi, Jim. It's great to be talking with you.
Well, thanks for having me.
The reason I was particularly interested in interviewing you today is that this is a new year, 2016. 2017, and we have a new administration coming on board and a new chance to look at our money system. So you've actually written on that subject a while back, and so have I, but I thought it would be good to go over the history of banking and currency, and specifically state-owned banks. The Public Banking Institute was formed in 2011, and we immediately had 20 bills, like within the next year, we had 20 states that had bills pending of one sort or another for state-owned banks, and one of those was Vermont, but none of those bills has actually passed. But now we have a new wave of interest. We've got 7 states, I think, that have new bills pending or about to be filed. That's Arizona, Illinois, New Hampshire, Washington, Michigan, Vermont, Maine, and Massachusetts. Those last three are pending. And then we have 4 cities with active bills, Oakland, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Manchester, New Hampshire, and several other cities. So we have all this active interest, and what's happening is we're getting the same questions and the same objections that we got before. So I thought it would be useful to go over particularly your experience in Vermont and your very knowledgeable writing on the history of the first Vermont state bank, which was set up in 1806, probably the first state bank in the country, and maybe the first state bank in the U.S. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your article and what you were started with the Bank of England and how that had changed the world?
Yes, if we go back to an arbitrary starting point, I would say 1694 is a good one, because that's the formation of the Bank of England, which, long story short, put the world on a war footing, because then sovereigns were no longer sovereign once the bank was formed, but sovereigns thought that then they could borrow all the money they wanted, and they could prosecute any war that they wanted to engage in, and that would settle their financial problems because they could always get money from the bank. And so the war went on what I would call, and what some historians call, a war footing, but it certainly changed the world.
So right at the same time, like 1691, was the first colonial scrip. It was issued by the governor of the colony of Massachusetts, who was fighting a little border war and needed money, and there was nobody to borrow from. We didn't have much in the way of gold. There were no banks around to borrow from, and so he got this bright idea that he would just issue his own paper currency. And so that was a competitive model that came online right along with the Bank of England, and it was wildly successful, as we know, that the colonies flourished, and the British were marveled that these colonial pioneers were, that in this wilderness where there wasn't much of anything, suddenly were doing very well. And of course, in Pennsylvania, that was particularly successful currency, because rather than just printing it and spending it, which did tend to hyperinflate some of the northern colonies, in Pennsylvania, they formed a bank, a publicly owned bank. It wasn't even really a building. It was just an office in the government, but it was a land bank where mm-hmm. the currency was supposedly backed by land, although they never actually took the land for it. Anyway, so they issued money, lent it to the farmers, and then the money came back. And, of course, they could issue a little extra to cover the interest. So it was a very sustainable system. And Pennsylvania, where there was nothing before, not much action, nothing going on because they didn't have money for trade, suddenly flourished. And Benjamin Franklin wrote about it and popularized the whole idea. He was called the father of paper money, although he didn't really invent it, but he popularized
it. He was a printer.
Yeah, he printed the money, so he did have a sort of, yeah.
The anecdote that we love to tell is that the Brits were amazed at this, and they asked Benjamin Franklin when he went over there how it happened, and he made the mistake of actually explaining it to them, and they then proceeded to shut it down, which I call the threat of the good example, because the bankers were horrified that this could happen without them, because they knew that their wealth and the wealth of the aristocracy was predicated on stealing money through interest and compound interest and all that by sucking off the the cream of trade. And so it was the British East India Company and the banks that insisted on the war to stop the colonies from doing this.
Right. Well, first they forbade the colonies to print their own money, and then there was a big depression, as there would be, of course. They didn't have any currency all of a sudden. So they went back to printing their own money, and then that was called an act of rebellion because they had rebelled against this order of the king.
Yeah, and I wish that history was clearer on that point. It's not that history ignores it, because I just reread one of my high school history books. It's not like a regular, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened history book, but it was a history book of articles written at the time. And they were, and these articles were quite clearly pointing at the economic hardship caused by the Brits that stimulated the antagonism that led to the War of Independence. And so I was happy to see that, even though, like, one out of 100 Americans realizes that hardship, that economic hardship was the real driver of the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is a major problem with the history we get to read, and the reason kids are bored in school, because they're just given it as one fact after another. This happened, and then that happened. And that's like when I wrote Web of Debt, that's what keenly interested me, was peeling back those layers and finding out what was really linking all this together and what really happened. But you've explained that with the State Bank of Vermont, which was founded in 1806. So what was going on in Vermont and what issues they had with currency then?
So the idea came about in 1803 because they were short of currency and they didn't know what to do about it. And so the first thing that came to most of their heads was, well, let's let some of these private banks form, and that'll take care of that problem. But there was a lot of resistance in 1803, right up through 1806, to private banks. And I'll give you some of the quotes that were circulating at the time, because people then were much more knowledgeable, for some reason, about money and banking than they are today. And there were 8 reasons listed why the banks were forbidden to get charters at the time. And I'll read 3 of those reasons. This is a quote from the time. Banks, by facilitating enterprises both hazardous and unjustifiable, are a natural source of all that class of vices which arise from the gambling system and which cannot fail to act as sure and fatal, though slow, poisons to the republic in which they exist. Now, that is a real mouthful.
Yep, that's pretty insightful. I'm wondering even what banks they're talking about, because we didn't have a lot of private banks then, I don't think. Maybe they're looking to Europe.
Well, they are. They're looking to banking in general, because a lot of those people had come from Europe, and they may or may not have been victims of banking, but it was quite obvious that the money that they're talking about here was not money dealt for the common good. I mean, banks invest in things that are going to make them money, and those kinds of things aren't necessarily good for society, or they're not good for the country at large.
Right. And even then, I presume the banks were printing their own banknotes, so they were printing many more notes than they had gold, which made them very risky, and you could lose your shirt.
Yes. If we're looking at the English banks, they operated on the same idea that you print a lot more paper than you have specie behind it. But I'll read you another reason why they wouldn't allow banks to form in Vermont. Banks have a violent tendency in their natural operation to draw into the hands of the few a large proportion of the property at present fortunately diffused among the many.
Ooh.
The tendency of banks seems to be to weaken the great pillars of a republican government and at the same time to increase the forces employed for its overthrow.
And wow, that's so relevant today, because now we have a super concentration of wealth.
And they can do things that are so corrupt and murderous and they stride the globe like a colossus because they have so much money that they can just throw it around in any way they can. And so it does indeed concentrate in the hands of psychopaths, and they can do whatever they want. You know, they can wipe out a population and nobody can do anything about it. They can extract resources and kill anybody who's in their way. I mean, that's the history of colonization, mm-hmm. and it goes on under the name of, you know, neoliberalism now.
That's really interesting that they pegged that back in 1803 or so, though.
Yeah, they saw that the concentration of money is not good.
Right.
That's something that was clear to them, that as you concentrate
If you have a bank, that it will concentrate money because of usury, basically, because they create the money, they put it out there, they take back that money plus more.
Yep.
So the third reason
they gave for not allowing banks is, as banks will credit none but persons of affluence, those who are in greatest need of help cannot expect to be directly accommodated by them.
Mm-hmm. That's another problem we see today, where it's big business that gets all the good deals.
Yeah.
The banks themselves get very, very low interest rates, and then they lend out at much higher interest rates, if at all, to local businesses.
Mm-hmm. And even the supposedly helpful things, like in Vermont, we have the Community Development Fund, we have the Vermont Economic Development Authority, and at the risk of being a heretic, I would say, what's the difference between those things that are created for the public good and a loan shark? Because by the time they get the money, they've already paid interest to borrow that money. So then they have their employees, and they have their rent, and they have their debt, and they have to charge the borrower, which is some poor schmuck who can't get a loan from the bank. Then they have to charge the borrower, you know, $9-$10 above the interest rate. And so they're supposedly created in the public good. So this is all because banks do what banks do. And this was clearly seen, that they had a violent tendency, that they accumulated money and did bad things with it, not good, and that they worked for the wealthy and not for the poor. So they got this idea, well, what if the state had a bank, and the mandate of the state was to help agriculture and to help small businesses and to keep businesses afloat, et cetera, et cetera? Well, they eventually got the votes, and the governor concurred, and they laid it out very carefully that that would be the purpose of the bank, and the bank would not overextend itself, and they had the rules to prevent that from happening. And the bank was extremely, long story short, the bank was extremely successful. The first year that it was in full operation, they had a profit. The next year, they doubled that. The next year, they had more, and the next year, they had a lot more. By 1811, they had a profit of $44,769.11, which wasn't chicken feed in those days. So that was another example of the threat of the good example, and the private banks and the counterfeiters and the usurers, the private usurers, and the other states nearby felt intimidated by this wonderful invention called a state bank and worked to end it. And I could list all the different things that happened to work on the end of this bank. They did eventually intimidate the legislature sufficiently to kill the bank, and so it went away.
Mm-hmm. And then you've mentioned other successful examples globally. Well, there's the North Dakota model, of course, which we always mm-hmm. use as, I mean, it's our one and only currently existing state-owned bank, and it's been wildly successful, but it was set up under similar circumstances to Vermont, where the people were struggling and they wanted to have their money within the state. They wanted state sovereignty.
Well, I agree with you completely. It's a fascinating story, and if any of you can get a hold of the movie that was made of it called Northern Lights, it's a heartwarming movie, and it shows how the farmers worked together to create a platform of officers for the state that would make this happen. And that whole movement was attacked viciously by the banking cartel, the Grange, and everybody in any position of authority, and they found ways to undermine it and then blame it, which is the old story. You know, ruin something and then blame something else for it. And that's what happened with the Bank of North Dakota, where they co-opted it with a new legislature and a new governor, but they saw what a wonderful idea it was, and they hung on to it. And out of that eventually grew the Bank of North Dakota that they have today.
Another great movie on it is called The Bank of North Dakota, and it's a half an hour, and it's just mm-hmm. a historical documentary, but it's also quite heartwarming. But it says that the party that overthrew the Nonpartisan League, just mm-hmm. when they got into power, the bank got funded. And so mm-hmm. there they were with the bank, and so they actually operated it like a bank, which was a bit brutal on the farmers because they did foreclose on the bad loans. But they got it in shape and up and running, and now it's doing marvelously well.
Yeah, and we're always faced with the big lie that they're only doing well because North Dakota has oil. And it's hard to, you know, the lie flies and the truth comes limping afterwards. And we point out that the bank was extremely successful before the oil boom. And so that's
right, and also they've had an oil bust for the last 2 years, and yet the Bank of North Dakota is still making 1% and 2% loans. They had their record profit. Every year they've had higher profits than the year before. And in December 2015, it was like reported last year, but the last year that they've come out with their profits, they were more successful than ever. So it's obviously not oil profits. We need to go over.
And as you know, I mean, Walt just interviewed Gwen, right? Because she's looking at Barkhausen, which is another successful entity like the Bank of North Dakota, which has over 50%, if I understand it correctly, of deposits in Germany. And the Deutsche Bank, et cetera, are trying to kill it because it's so successful. And so it's the same old story where the better something is, the better the example it sets, the more the big banks go after it to try to stop it. But they failed in Germany, and they failed in North Dakota. The bank goes on. So the bank in Vermont, well, it was shut down because the legislature was afraid that there would be too many claims on the specie, which is the gold and silver, that sort of thing, because the speculators had set up their scam so that they would have a lot of the notes, and then they'd go back to Vermont and say, I want the gold. And so that was that scam, and the counterfeiting was one of the major things that brought, you know, that ended the bank. But that could end any bank, and in fact it did. You know, the private banks were having big problems for the same reasons, but that's okay because they're private.
Yeah, basically. I get the argument that there were state banks in the 19th century that failed, like three of them perhaps. But look at all the private banks that failed, and it certainly hasn't stopped them from thriving in this century.
And the state banks failed for different reasons than the private banks. You know, state banks failed because there was a concerted effort to undermine them.
And then the recent Vermont State Bank bill, what came at that?
So over the last few years, Anthony Polina introduced three different bills, and John Ford and Gwen introduced the Warrants bill, like the one in California, which it could be brought up again. But the three state bank type bills all failed. And the last one looked like it was going to pass because we had 5-0 in the first committee. And I forget, there was government ops, there was finance, I forget the names of the committees, but 5-0 in one committee, 6-1 in the second committee. And something really underhanded happened between the treasurer and the chair of that committee, I'm suggesting, because it never made it to the third committee. And so with a 5-1 and a 6-1 vote, it was definitely going to pass in the third committee because of all the momentum that it had and all the support that it had from the legislature. So they didn't want that, I guess. And between the private banks and the treasurer, with faint praise and certain questions, it didn't make it to the third committee on time. And when I spoke to the chair of that committee, she just threw up her hands and said, well, what could I do? I didn't get the bill. So clearly there was some underhanded work going on there, and that's what I posted at the Public Banking Institute thread, that don't get too optimistic just because you have a lot of support and it looks like it's going to sail through. There's always a fly in the ointment given the power of these private banks.
Right.
So watch out for that.
Well, it is a problem with legislators in general that, of course, they want to preserve their jobs, so they want all their bases covered or body parts or whatever, and so they don't want to venture out into the unknown unless they have a big support group and, you know, they have legal advice, et cetera, that it's all good and it's going to pay off. So that is the challenge that we're always up against. But we do have a lot of more and more support, so I think that's very helpful for working with legislators.
Yeah, and it's tough to get the support because how do you educate people be supportive?
And interestingly, it seems to me that the legislators that are the easiest to persuade are the ones who have been bankers. So they understand how banking works. They understand that banks just create money, that the state, of course, needs money, and this is the way to get it out there.
The tragedy in our group was that Gary Murphy fell down the stairs and died. And he was my partner in trying to make the legislature and the treasurer a little bit more. Well, I'll read you the last paragraph of my article. My conclusion is, this article focused on the financial aspects of a state bank. It hardly mentioned the philosophical, spiritual, and moral issues associated with freedom, liberty, and emancipation. Issues that have always been dear to our hearts since Vermont created herself as an independent republic in 1777. These ideals are antithetical to the present monetary system. But despite what we profess, we are supporting what is deeply corrupt. Divestiture from Wall Street and the Federal Reserve is the moral high ground if we want to take it. The fact that a state bank would also be profitable should make it a no-brainer. We well know that our public servants have a strong aversion to risk, but in the words of Gary Murphy, I quote, it's too bad they don't have a strong aversion to doing business with financial institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Wells Fargo et al. That are ripping us off and that will take all our money when the next crash comes. We have plenty of evidence that demonstrates the extreme riskiness of doing business with these institutions, end quote.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of that, I might just mention, you know, all the way up to the Dodd-Frank Act requires the big banks to have living wills that show that they wouldn't, that they can fail without taking down the economy. So they're not too big to fail. In other words, they can fail and they can solve their own problems. And all the way up to last spring, there were still, I think, five banks that hadn't satisfied that requirement. And now, recently, Janet Yellen has said that she's satisfied. All of them, I guess, have, except Wells Fargo. And she says that they have ways of recapturing their, well, basically, it's bail-ins. In other words, what they're going to do to save themselves is bail in our money.
Yeah.
So it's not saving us, the people. It might be saving the government, meaning the taxpayers, but we, the people who are either depositors or bondholders or stockholders in these banks, are going to get wiped out, including the states themselves, which have huge amounts of money in these Wall Street banks. They think they're protected by collateral, but the problem is that derivatives and repos go ahead of everybody else in bankruptcy. So they get to take all the collateral, and then whatever is left gets divvied up among the other supposedly secured.
Yeah. So Gary Murphy and I met with the treasurer, and we explained that to her, and she says, oh, no, it's collateralized, so we don't have to worry about that.
And yeah, but that's the thing. Their collateral is below.
Yeah, I know. We explained that. I wrote about that in this article. And it's like, you know, real fears don't seem to settle on people. You tell them something like, you know, in Cyprus what happened and what happened here, and this is all set up now through Dodd-Frank to happen in the U.S. They look at you like fish in a goldfish bowl. It just doesn't register. So we'll see when the banks go bust, we'll see whether they start taking deposits from people.
Well, they'll definitely be taking bondholders' money, and this includes those cocoa bonds that are held by the pension funds largely, where they thought they were buying something like CDs. It's just like what happened in Italy, where they thought they were buying CDs, safe investments, you know, large money investments that pay a little interest. And in fact, what they got was convertible bonds that can be turned into stock in the event of a crisis. So what they wind up with is stock in a worthless bank.
Yeah, and that's what Dodd-Frank has arranged.
Yeah, and that's actually what their new living wills are going to do. That's how they're going to save themselves, is with, once again, with our money.
You did mention success stories, and I just wanted to quickly mention Guernsey is probably the greatest success story, and it was so simple. Guernsey was in a financial crisis in 1812, and they were in a physical crisis because the retaining walls were being washed away by the sea, and they didn't know what to do about it. And the anecdote is, some visitor was there, and he said, "Well, so I guess you don't have the people to rebuild the wall." And they said, "Oh, no, we have all these wonderful skilled craftsmen who can rebuild the wall. So I guess you don't have the materials with which to build the wall." And, "Oh, no, no, we've got all the stones and the boulders, and we've got the industry to cut them." "Oh, no, we can do that. That's no problem." So the guy says, "Well, what are you waiting for? Why don't you just do it?" And they said, "Well, we don't have any money." "Money? Well, what's that have to do with it? You just create a sovereign currency, and you pay them, and you use that money in Guernsey for all your needs, and you'll have a retaining wall." And I went, "Oh, okay." And so they, in fact, did that, and that saved Guernsey from being washed away by the sea. And it's a mini, perfectly true, you can look it up, you can Google it, it's a simple little story of how that works. And the Patacone worked in a similar way, where the money was spread, was issued like a California warrant. It was so successful that it spread throughout the country from one region to another. 20% of the workforce was paid that way. It was responsible for about 13% of the economy. And it was indeed so successful that the IMF conspired to make sure that it got shut down. And they bought it out at par, which was pretty cool. You've got 13% of your economy in what they were calling just public-generated fictitious money, which was bought out on a par with the peso, which is proof, positive, of the success of public money. And again, my theory is it was the success of the good example that made sure that that thing got shut down and never brought up again.
Yeah, and you can see what's happening to Argentina now. I mean, they've gone after all the sort of public sector, all the successful Latin American countries that had a successful model that you might call socialist or non-neoliberal, what was obviously a very successful economy until the big bankers came in to crush it.
Well, of course, Perkins wrote it all up in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where
right.
That's the idea is you create a debt in a country, suck all the money, and then you've got an automatic, your side benefit, your collateral benefit is you have a population that is hungry and thirsty and doesn't have shelter, and they will work for peanuts for anything, like in the Philippines right now. You have this huge population, and one of the great resources in the Philippines now is these poor people who will work anywhere in the world cheap. So they go to Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and all over to work cheap. And that's, I guess some people call that a success story, is that people are starving in your country because you're too stupid to create a local currency that would free up their international currency to buy things like, you know, you have to buy with an international currency, oil, gas, other stuff like that.
Your story of the man who's, where they said, "No, we've got the workers, we've got the materials." Mm-hmm. I heard that story. In fact, I actually told it in a conference as a spaceman who came to Louisiana right after the big flood in New Orleans. Same deal, but in the end, he says, "Beam me up, Scotty. There's no intelligent life on Earth." But it also reminds me of Lincoln was told, supposedly, mm-hmm. by a friend. He said, "You know, you don't have to borrow that money from those big British bankers who are going to charge you 24 to 36%. You can just issue the money. That's legal, you know, it's in their constitution. And so he did it. And it seems to me that's where we are now, that there are things that could be done that have been done before, but the legislators just don't even think of them. They don't realize that they've got the power to do that. That's what they said when the Federal Reserve issued quantitative easing. One legislator said, oh, we didn't know you could do that. And they said that in the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt took the dollar off the gold standard. They said, oh, we didn't realize you could do that. So we're at the place where we seem to have come to the end of the line with this debt-based usurious model, and we need to start over. And so we need to be looking to our roots to see what it is we can do and what's actually been done very successfully before.
And we didn't even mention today the tally sticks that were successful for 700 years, which turned an accounting system, a simple accounting system, into a currency.
Right. So it was the same deal, but it was basically a more secure form of paper because you couldn't counterfeit it. So that's all been super interesting. Give your things to point people toward your work.
I can give you the website of John Ford, which is Vermont Currency Commons, and you'll get an explanation. Those of you in California, you'll get an explanation for what indeed happened in California with the warrants and how they were even much more successful in Argentina. And then he has 5 points, 5 stages of a successful currency issued as a warrant, the end of which is that it becomes the currency of the country. And you can have more than one, which is healthy, as you know. So anyway, that website is, or you can just Google Vermont Currency Commons. And then you can look through that for different articles, but the one you want is called Colonial Finance Redux in the California Republic.
Okay, that sounds great. Okay, well, we may manage to get it up on the Public Banking Institute blog as well. I've been speaking with Jim Hogue, actor, teacher, farmer, radio talk show host, and longtime public banking advocate from Vermont.
Has the consumer age run its course? Are we seeing the beginning of the end of the grand matrix of our economy, consumption and consumerism, driven by a personal desire to acquire and possess stuff? Are the demographic and lifestyle trends and traditions changing to the point that we must now start thinking about what might replace it? Well, Dr. Maury Cohen, a professor and economist, thinks so, and his book, The Future of Consumer Society, Prospects for Sustainability in the New Economy, outlines why this phenomenon is in motion now all around us. Dr. Cohen thinks the beginning of the end took shape a few decades ago.
When we look to critique consumerism as a lifestyle practice, or the consumer society as a system of social and economic organization, the tendency has been to look at advertising and marketing and the role of communications, in particular television, and more recently the internet and social media. My focus has been on looking at the foundation stones, or what I refer to in the book as the pillars of consumer society, the macro structural elements that have been responsible for its development and for its social reproduction over the last 5 or 6 decades, and that those foundational pillars are beginning to erode, and that trends that have been largely facilitative and positive in encouraging the expansion of consumer society are now being thrown into reverse. Mm-hmm. So specifically, there are 5 trends that I point to in the book, first of all being demographic aging and the fact that the American population is growing older, that consumerism as a lifestyle practice very much developed in concert with the life trend, the baby boomers, as baby boomers are beginning to retire and develop new lifestyle practices, that the emphasis on accumulation and materialism are beginning to shift. Second factor is a growing trend in income inequality. that sizable numbers of people are losing the capacity financially to perform as consumers as they previously had. A third factor, not unrelated to income inequality, is the emergence of contingent and what sometimes is referred to as gig economy jobs. So it was just reported in Economist that 15% of the American workforce is now working on a contingent basis. And so this speaks to this trend of the decline of wage-based employment. Fourth factor being inadequate public investment. Private consumption needs to be built on the back of public investment. And so as there has been a decline in public investment, that has had an impact on the ability of consumerist lifestyles to be recreated and to endure. And then finally is the emergence of a new set of lifestyle preferences and cultural values on the part of the millennial generation. So it's important not to overstate this point, that it's easy to sort of fall into the trap that, you know, all millennials are flocking to cities and forsaking life in suburbs and exurbs and rural areas. But as a leading edge in terms of establishing new lifestyle preferences, what we might think of as a kind of cultural elite is certainly demonstrating a preference for urban living, and that's having significant implications in terms of home ownership, the prevalence of automobile ownership and use, and what some people have referred to as the peak car moment. So if we think of cars and houses as being the two most significant consumer goods, both of those are experiencing some very significant change in the role that they occupy in consumption and lifestyles.
As people find themselves squeezed out of a consumer-based economic system, where do they go?
That's the $64,000 question. I think there's sound reason to think that what we're seeing here is the sort of second wave of a process that really began during the middle of the 20th century. Most of us are familiar with the long-standing process of deindustrialization. And deindustrialization is a process that we understand as unfolding on the production side of the economy, but as a result of a wave of interventions during the 1970s, financialization, deregulation, we've sort of been able to keep consumer lifestyles going, almost on life support, if you want to think about it in those terms, most particularly through the loosening of credit availability, the much more substantially widespread use of credit cards and other forms of credit as a form of enabling consumer purchases. You know, that process has more or less reached its end, and that what we're seeing now is a breakdown in what oftentimes is thought of as being the virtuous economic cycle, that rising wages enable people to consume more, and that we've seen now for the last couple of decades a pattern of wage stagnation at virtually all levels of the income distribution, with the exception, of course, of the uppermost segments. And so that's putting, you know, downward pressure on the ability of people to maintain lifestyles that they've become accustomed to.
Forced foundational changes in lifestyle can challenge an individual's sense of self and of belonging to the community at large.
The role of consumption in enabling the establishment and the display and demonstration of identity and status has been massively important. If we look back a little bit longer historically, it was customary for many people to sort of maintain and project their status and identity on the basis of their role in the production system. And that process had sort of given way beginning in the 1960s, 1970s, increasingly to the role of consumption as being the primary means of maintaining and establishing identity. And as people increasingly fail to be able to achieve their consumption aspirations, I think that's an important factor in the very, very complicated political terrain that we see in the United States and increasingly in other countries as well. that what is understood as being a good life or the kind of lifestyle that that people aspire to is coming under more and more pressure. We hear in the United States on a regular and consistent basis the fact that the millennial generation is not going to be able to achieve the same standard of living that their parents were able to enjoy. And so that is becoming a source of great frustration, a great source of alienation and disaffection as people have to recalibrate their understanding of how their lives are going to unfold and to adapt themselves to a set of expectations that are quite different from what they had previously anticipated.
Not being able to adequately participate in a consumer society, in part because of massive amounts of personal debt, has moved many people so far down the ladder of equity and prospect that they must merely trade their time to pay their bills to their creditors.
In many respects, I think we're reverting to a kind of neo-peasantization. You know, we may look back another couple of decades from now and realize that this period of industrialization, particularly the pattern of industrialization that existed in a country like the United States during the decades following World War II, was an extremely unique historical moment, one in which people with fairly modest levels of education could roll out of high school or maybe even not even graduate high school, go across the street to an industrial facility and take on a job that, you know, enabled them to achieve the circumstances and objectives of the American dream. They were able to buy a house, they were able to buy a car, they were able to go on vacation once or twice a year, they were able to buy a television, furnish their homes, live at a level of comfort and convenience that was fairly unprecedented historically. And that now, as those jobs have disappeared and the consumption associated with earning at that level has dissipated, that we see large parts of the country reverting to a form of a level of economic organization that, you know, almost is feudal in how it's organized.
So as money retreats to its cloistered centers of control, and people try to fend for themselves in a new world order that has edged them out, talk of introducing money as a basic utilitarian device through a basic income scheme is emerging.
It's been stunning to me to see that over the last 6-12 months that the proposition of a guaranteed basic income or a universal basic income really seems to be sweeping across policy spaces and advocacy groups in a way that I think is really pretty rare and surprising. It will become increasingly unavoidable for governments to dismiss arguments in favor of a basic income. And in fact, as we've seen the labor force participation rate decline in the United States, especially among white men, that other forms of public assistance, most notably disability insurance, has come to function for many people as a de facto basic income. And much of the social stigma that had previously been associated with public programs like disability has in many communities ebbed away. And so I see that as a positive development. As more and more people become reliant on it, invariably we'll see that stigma begin to disappear. What we really need to begin to think about is how we develop alternative provisioning systems that enable people to meet their livelihood needs in ways that don't exclusively rely on cash money.
That's Dr. Maury Cohen, professor and author of the book called The Future of Consumer Society, Prospects for Sustainability in the New Economy. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.